and they could do 57 ounce copper. That's like, I forget what it comes out to, but it's something like a quarter inch thick copper.
That's almost a joke. Like,
it's ridiculous.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Altium On Track podcast. I am your host, Zach Peterson. I'm very happy to be here today with Mario Strano, senior PCB designer at Nikola and also president of ECAD Central. We're going to be talking to him today about his journey and eventually making it to work at Nikola and also what he does through his business, ECAD Central. Mario, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks, Zach. Thanks for having me on.
You know, you've never been on the podcast before, but I know you actually do some work servicing Altium customers through ECAD Central. Maybe before we talk about that and what folks need from ECAD Central, maybe we can learn a little bit more about you and your background and how you got to where you are at Nikola.
Yeah, sure. So I started doing PCB design 14 years ago. I was working for a startup company called Sequelon Semiconductor. It was acquired by Texas Instruments, and then a position opened up to learn PCB design from the ground up. My manager at the time taught me best practices for PCB design for power electronics. It was a power supply business unit that I worked at for Texas Instruments. Learned pads and did design work in Mentor Graphics pads for about 2 years. Did a few designs in Orcad Allegro as well, but for the last 12 years, I've been using Altium Designer exclusively. So basically, I worked at several companies as a PCB designer since my time at TI. I worked as a component engineer slash PCB designer as well at Avnet for 6 years. I'm currently the only PCB designer at Nikola Motor Corporation right now. We're going to hire on at least one other person, though. We're starting to get to the point where time schedules are going to be impacted negatively if we don't get another resource. And that's pretty much that. I did a lot of EC or evaluation modules when I was at Texas Instruments for these power supply, you know, power phases and whatnot. So I got really good at doing power electronics, but PCB designs. But when it comes to the work that I'm doing at Nikola, we're doing 10-ounce copper boards, real heavy power boards, as well as I'm also doing HMI boards, human machine interface boards, such as like the board that controls the user gauges, heads up, or the user's gauges, and then also the infotainment, you know, there's the GPS maps and audio and video, the camera interface, everything goes through the human machine interface board that I did. And also we do all the ECUs, electronic control units. They're basically boards or designs that control aspects of the vehicle. One of them is a vehicle control module, and one of the main functions of that is to translate the user's accelerator pedal into, you know, signals that drive the whole vehicle propulsion. And I guess that's about it, unless you have any other questions on that.
So you said you started in a semiconductor company before it got bought out by Texas Instruments, was that correct?
Yeah, so Sequelon Semiconductor, they designed they were started by a few people who worked for, I think at the time it was Lucent, and they were working on a type of FET that the project had gotten canceled, and they asked Lucent if they could buy the patent rights to that technology. They did, and they started a company, and they were doing some kind of RF FETs, and then they used that technology to do standard MOSFETs for power electronics, and they had some really good advantages to the technology. I wasn't a product engineer, so I don't know exactly what the difference is between your standard FETs and these kind of FETs, but they were just really efficient, and Texas Instruments liked what they had. Texas Instruments at the time didn't have any FETs, so a lot of their evaluation boards would have their controller and their PWM generator, but they'd have to use somebody else's FETs, and obviously that wasn't desirable, so they decided to buy the company I was working for.
That's interesting, because when you said you worked at a semiconductor company, I had this image in my head of you doing, like, microcontrollers or something like this.
No, it was all power electronics. You know, it was just really FETs. Like, they had, you know, N-channel, P-channel, and then they had in one package an N and a P-FET, you know, stacked die on top of each other. They had, I think they had other ones that had, like, an integrated PWM chip inside with the two FETs, all about just, you know, real estate savings for, you know, designing this onto a motherboard. And that's the kind of market they had. They one of the customers, probably still one of their customers, is Apple. I know at the time when I worked for them, that was a big customer of theirs, and they actually got that customer before the TI acquired them. So they it was a really good technology, but again, pretty much anything that had to do with the power phases around, you know, a motherboard, that's the types of semiconductors that they developed.
And so now, being at Nikola and working on, as you said, 10-ounce copper boards, I could imagine that's a bit of a shift in mindset. Or do you find that there are similarities there with what you used to do at C-Clone?
Yeah, I mean, the only thing is, you know, I also worked for a design services house for Avnet. Avnet had acquired Premier Farnell, and Premier Farnell, prior to the Avnet acquisition, had acquired a design services house. So when I was at Avnet the last few years, I worked for the design services house. So I saw, you know, a lot of other designs between the time I was doing stuff at TI and Nikola, But the main difference really is just learning the creepaging, how to set up creepaging clearance rules for the heavy copper. Clearance is pretty straightforward. Creepage took a little, it was a little bit of a learning curve because I hadn't used that feature in Altium. But, you know, really what it comes down to is primarily you just have larger gaps. The higher heavier copper weight you go up, you have to have larger line widths and spaces.
So is that due to risk of EST?
The primary concern is creepage at high voltage, you know, the and also high current. Some of the modules that the boards that I did the PCB design for, they control IGBTs that are capable of 1200 volts at 1800 amps. And three per board. So,
yeah,
you know, so this really high voltages on these things, and so very large creepage and clearance requirements, you know, on those high voltage sections to high voltage to low voltage, and then some high voltage to its own reference ground. Of course, you don't want dead shorts, or you don't want shorts due to voltage creeping across the board.
Sure. When I hear 10-ounce copper, I'm thinking this is super high current, and maybe it isn't super high voltage.
That's not always the case. But for what we do, you know, we're dealing with motor drives and various kinds of designs that would go on a semi-truck, right? An electric semi-truck. Mm-hmm. So we're dealing with high current and high voltage.
Right, electrified semi-trucks, so they've got a huge battery pack somewhere, and then you're routing all that power through these control boards.
Yeah.
Essentially. I
mean, yeah, not all the current passes through, like, say, the one board that I was talking about that's controlling these FETs, or IGBTs, but there are some boards. I'm doing a design right now that I think it's 180 amps are going through the board.
That's a lot of amps.
Yeah, I mean, through the PCB.
sure. Well, I mean, so in backplanes that I've done, some backplanes can get to that level of current, but you're not going to see, you know, 10-ounce copper. They're going to interleave a bunch of copper in different layers because it's already going to be a higher layer count board.
Right.
And that's how they get the copper capacity. And so I think it ends up working out to the equivalent of 10 ounces of copper if you were to take all that copper and stack it up on each other.
It probably would. There's a little disadvantage in that when you have one chuck of copper as opposed to, like, you know, one 10-ounce layer as opposed to 5 2-ounce layers that are stitched together, you know, it's obviously more thermally efficient and electrically efficient to just have one solid layer that is 10-ounce, right?
I think so, yeah. Actually, I think that would make sense, and depending on how you divide up the currents, right? Because maybe one of those layers gets the bulk of the current, and so the bulk of the heat is being generated there, whereas in other layers it's lower current, so it's not so much heat. They can accept some of that heat from that other, from that layer that's doing the bulk of the heat generation.
Yeah.
Is that the right way you would think about it?
Yeah, no, that's fair to say. I mean, what it really comes down to, like the one that I'm doing right now, it's a system of a couple of boards, right? So we have the gate drive board, and then we have the power board, and the gate drive board has, you know, it's only 2-ounce copper, it's 6-layer, and it has all the control circuitry and everything for that, you know, that mates, you know, and then it mates through connectors with the power board, whose main purpose is just to pass that, you know, the high voltage and current. So that's only a 2-layer board, the power board that I'm talking about for this application. But you could have a, you know, 6-8-layer stack up that has 2-ounce externally, have all the control circuitry on that, and have, you know, internal layers that are 8, 10 ounce, or, you know, I think the one fab house that we're using can do up to 15 or 20 ounce, but the, there's another place called Taiyo Kogyo, I think it's called. It's in Japan, and they could do 57-ounce copper. That's like, I forget what it comes out to, but it's something like a 1/4-inch thick copper.
That's almost a joke. Like, okay, so I only say that because, like, I get emails from, you know, manufacturers overseas all the time. And sometimes they're a little ridiculous, like, you know, we'll do a 48-layer HDI PCB, and I'm thinking, okay, no you won't, but, you know, when you hear, like, oh, 57-ounce copper, like, that can't be a thing, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, this company, they have some proprietary processes that allow them to do things like embedded bus bars, you know.
Okay.
So they could also do on one layer. They could have up to, I think it's like 10 ounce area and a 2-ounce area on one layer.
Mm, okay.
So they have, but they're the only ones I heard of that can do that. And the advantage of that is instead of having the system, like I talked about, having a control board and then having the power board, you could have the control circuitry in one area and then have the heavy copper power in another area, that same board. It's kind of interesting, though, because you're like, well, how would I define that in Altium or any other tool for that matter?
That's exactly what I was just wondering.
Yeah, so the way that it would be done is you assign mechanical layers for, okay, this is a bus bar layer, right? And then you just define that in your fab documentation, send it to them, and then they translate that. Because, yeah, I don't think there's any software that can actually handle that, just from, you know, any kind of modern PCB design software.
Well, sure. I mean, it's so conditioned to operate with just whatever the thickness is, the copper weight is, on just that one layer.
Yeah.
So, but when you say an embedded bus bar, I think you mean, and correct me if I'm wrong, but like a large bus bar that maybe passes through a cutout into multiple layers, and it just ends up being a very thick piece of copper. Is that, that's not correct?
No, it's actually embedded in the stack up.
Oh, okay.
And the leads come out, like, say, the middle of the stack up, and then hook up to your battery or whatever it is that you need the bus bars for.
Okay, I see. That's interesting. Okay.
Yeah, it's called, again, Taiyo, like Taiyo Yuden, Taiyo Kogyo, Kogyo. Again, I don't know how you pronounce that exactly, but they're in Japan, and yeah, if anybody needs their services, they do stuff that I've never heard of anybody ever even talking about.
I've seen on some websites where they talk about, I think, like 15 ounce or 30 ounce copper, but 57, I think, is the new record.
Yeah, and I think they're when it comes to having the heavy copper and the like 2 ounce copper on one layer, I'm not 100% sure, but I think there's some process limitation that limits those heavy copper areas to 10 ounce. But you know, if you could embed a bus bar, I guess you know this shouldn't be a problem to get the power through the board that you want.
It's certainly. Yeah, and then I wonder what the process looks like for that, because in my head I imagine, you know, a cutout that's sized to fit the bus bar, and they just toss it in there, and then they put the top layers over it, or the outside layers over it, I should say. Yeah. But I'm sure it's much more elaborate than that, so
I'm
just speculating here.
Yeah, they're the only ones I ever heard that has the capability. The only problem with using a company like that has such a unique kind of process capability is that, you know, good luck shopping that around, you know. I mean, if the and I expressed some of the concerns. I'm like, well, you know, what happens if there's a typhoon and your facility gets wiped out? You know, then I just can't get my boards produced. Of course, sorry for you guys, but you know, I mean, I really hate using single source suppliers for anything. Components, you know, whenever they can be avoided, of course, I definitely try to get multiple source for, you know, footprint pin out and whatnot. But for the PCB, you're just, yeah. I mean, you can't just shop that around anywhere because of the unique processes they have. One of the things they said, though, is like if you order a board from them, you know, basically you put in an order for 3 years worth of boards, whatever it is, whatever you guys agree to, they produce all the boards at once. So they're not producing 100 boards 3 years down the road. They got them all produced, and they have some kind of way to preserve them, I guess. I'm not sure what they would use exactly, but I'm sure they'll gold plate it anyway. But but yeah, no, they have some ways to mitigate the risk because they understand that.
I suppose that makes sense. I mean, it's almost the same strategy that you have to use today when buying your microcontroller or certain ASICs or whatever it may be. Try and project where you're going to be at in a year, maybe 3 years, and buy as much as you can now if you can.
Yeah. It's kind of tough. I mean, I'm not an electrical engineer, but I do component engineering functions for the group that I'm in, mainly supply chain management, EOL, you know, obsolescence management and that kind of stuff. And then also finding alternates. I was a component engineer at Avnet for 6 years, so I know a lot about components. I'm just encouraging them to design in parts that they can find a pin-to-pin compatible and footprint compatible part. You know, of course, for logic ICs and things like that, it's easier to do. A lot of them have common pinouts, but again, when you get into PMICs and certain other types of parts, it just is what it is, you know.
Yeah, and then with some analog parts, or like I had to deal with this recently with an ADC, it's always nice if you can get pin compatible from the same vendor, but then specifications vary, and if you need really tight specifications, you may be out of luck.
Yeah, this is just crazy, the situation we're all in. I've never anywhere near this kind of stuck like we are in so many designs. I'm just having to buy parts to support production for 2-3 years just because they're just not around. You have to,
That was actually something I was going to ask you, was maybe what is your perspective on shortages over the long term? And I bring it up because I started working, you know, in the industry level in 2017. Before that, I was in academia doing, you know, research and teaching. So I was never having to go to DigiKey and buy, you know, 400 parts for an assembly or whatever it may be.
Yeah.
So this is my perspective on this is not as broad as I think some other folks. You know, my first experience with the word shortage in the context of electronics was with capacitors, you know, 2018-ish. Yeah. And then it seemed to roll over to semiconductors in 2020, 2021. And I'm wondering if you know, based on just your experience, you've seen this kind of shortage issue just roll around to different component classes.
Well, I think back the capacitor issue you're probably referring to, I think you're talking about tantalum caps.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there was an issue, some deal with, you know, this, I think it was like, there was a conflict minerals issue with tantalum in Africa and whatnot. And so some of that, you know, I think some of that was related to the shortage on that, but we haven't seen something as widespread as we are seeing now. It's ICs. It's even a lot of times capacitors as well. You know, your standard, you know, whatever, like 50 volt, you know, 100 microfarad electrolytic cap, surface mount, you know, sometimes you just can't get them. There's a shortage that's across all different types of components, even connectors.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting because it's like not only is the desired part out of stock, but the substitute is out of stock, and the substitute is out of stock.
Yeah. We had to design in, I think, like three different LIN transceivers because we designed in the one and then it wasn't available. Then the other one, that the alternate we selected was plentiful, and then it was gone. And then a third one. Fortunately, we found footprint and pin-to-pin compatibility there. But again, that's not the case typically with complex ICs. These aren't complex, I guess. They're pretty simple. But yeah, no, it's just crazy these days.
Well, and I've had to have standing alerts with on certain parts with, mm-hmm. with distributors in order to get some notification when they're having something come in stock. Yeah. And it's immediately over to the client. Hey, this is coming in. You know, how many do you want? How many should we get? And of course they're like all of them.
Yep. Exactly. Yeah. We're having, we're designing in an FPGA in a certain application. And, you know, they're talking 52 week lead time for the FPGA.
And in that instance, it's either alternative vendor, which impacts your development, because now you've basically got to translate all of that development over to that other vendor's development tool, or you got to just buy a larger FPGA and use less silicon.
Yeah. So what we're gonna do is we're gonna buy some dev kits, or we have some dev kits already for the FPGA we're gonna design in. So what we're probably going to do is use that reference. That's my kitty. We're going to use the dev kit to hook everything up. Maybe make a custom board that interfaces from the dev kit to our application or to the other boards in our system, and then you know, prove out everything, control circuitry, code, and everything. And once we get that all good to go. By the time we're ready to go to production, or have everything else proven out, you know, the hardware is the last variable, right? We'd have to do our own carrier design and, you know, maybe a SOM and a carrier, or just our own custom chip down FPGA design on, you know, with all the peripherals on it, whatever. It looks like we're gonna have to do that for this application because we just can't get the parts. Even getting samples, you know, to support just our prototype development, they're talking like 20 weeks. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. Wow. When you said you're buying dev boards or buying sound like evaluation products, I'm gonna be honest, I was a little concerned that you were about to say, well, we're gonna buy those and desolder, and that's how we're gonna get chips.
You know what? Actually, that was something that I was thinking about, just to prove out the, you know, like, I was thinking about maybe, you know, in desperation mode, maybe buying 5 eval boards just so we could just do some prototype validation. But it looks like what we're probably going to do is Avnet has a lot of good, really good FPGA reference designs. they also have their own series of products called Micro Z, Pico Z, and Ultra Z. They're just outstanding. When I worked at Avnet, I was in the board design group that designed those. Even those have long lead times, though, but we could probably get a few evaluation kits, Carrier and SOM, and just at least use that to, again, prove out or get our code and control circuitry all working with the system. And then down the road, either, buy SOMs in volume when they're there and use them in production. One of the things that Avnet will do with, licensing agreements and whatnot and a large NRE fee, they will sell you the design source files for their SOMs because it's an Avnet branded product. It's not just a dev kit or a dev board. These are their products. But you can purchase that. And, once you get the design files, you can do the chip down version, just integrate the board, the SOM with the carrier instead of having plug-in carrier. But the first phase would just be taking their SOM as it is, designing our own carrier, or taking their carrier source files, which they will give away, and just designing that system.
Interesting. Okay. I'd like to switch gears now for a moment, because I had mentioned in the intro that you have a company called ECAD Central. And for those that are listening and don't know, ECAD Central is actually an Altium partner in Arizona. Maybe you could tell us all what ECAD Central does.
Yeah, so basically what the services I provide are, Altium server setup and configuration. That's, whether it's, Nexus or Concord Pro or A365. We have about 8 years experience setting up these servers. I've personally set up dozens of these servers from scratch, several when I was at Avnet. I also did database migration going from Concord Pro to A365. I migrated all of our component data, all of our design source files. At the time, I don't know if there's anything now that makes that a shorter, quicker path, but at the time it was pretty much manual and it was like moving a mountain, and to have everything correct in the end, it's quite a feat. There's so many pitfalls that you could run into, but because I had a lot of experience prior to that with the software and creating database libraries, was able to do that successfully. I've done that for other customers as well. 9.connects is phenomenal when it comes to this kind of service as well. I've actually done a lot of contract work for them. They're a bigger organization than ECAD Central, but I'm cheaper.
Well, that's fair.
So basically what it is just set up the server setup and configuration, database migration. I also can do database administration if they don't have the bandwidth, custom component databases. I could create them and migrate them to their server, or I can create them for them and give them instructions how to migrate them as database libraries. I also do BOM maintenance service. So if you have especially these days where component shortages are just all too common, I can maintain your BOM and just basically ensure that you're aware when parts start going, become unavailable in distribution. Just basically be like a monthly service, and I just, scrub your BOM once a month and let you know of any problem parts that may be coming up based on your projected volumes that you need of those parts. Library cleanup and migration. A lot of places have site libraries, and then they want to go to a Altium database product like, all A365. And, sometimes you have libraries that are, engineer A, engineer B, and engineer C, and then you want to use all those parts, but there's slight variations in text, font, pin length, all these things, whatever. But I could take all those parts, clean them up, unify them in appearance and, all aspects that can be unified. And then give that back to you, or again, I could migrate that for you into into A365 or Concord Pro, whatever your database product is. And also I have about 40,000 parts that I created myself that are in my A365 server that I can migrate as is for a certain price. It just depends. I realize getting libraries from other people is always unknowns. You don't know what you're going to get, but I've been making my own parts for 14 years. It's very rare that I'll have an issue. Most of these parts, at least all the passive footprints, have been production proven. And also design source file conversion, I could do that for you. I've done that many times for all different tool-to-tool conversions, well, from other tools to Altium Designer. The only limitation I have when it comes to Altium database products is that I don't have a great amount of experience with, I don't have much experience at all with the Nexus Enterprise workflows or the PLM integration part of that. But other than that, I know these systems inside and out. I've been setting up these servers, using them for about 8 years now. But that's pretty much that.
So you brought up something interesting, because this is a question that I've been asked before, which is conversions and migration from another CAD platform, or maybe not full migration, but at least mirroring what's going on in your Altium server with respect to maybe what they have stored in another server as far as parts. Is that something that you've had to deal with? Like maybe, let's say a company wants to, they want to add Altium to their capabilities, but they've been working in pads for the last 10 years or whatever, and so they have all these parts in pads. Have you had experience making sure that those two systems play well together through either an Altium product or through maybe a third party system?
I haven't really done a lot of library conversion from tool to tool, but I can do it. I know how to ensure that the library is good. There's a lot of global edits. Altium has some really good global editing interfaces, such as the PCB Liblist editor, where you could globally change what's on mechanical layer 1 to mechanical layer 13 or whatever, So. If I get a library and port it into Altium, I could do global edits to clean things up and just make things comply with whatever Altium layer configuration they want. So I have the ability to do it. I just haven't done a lot of, this is my PADS library, please migrate it.
Well, because something that comes up that I've been asked is, someone will, or a company will say, we want to migrate to Altium, but we still have this giant stack of designs from the last 10 or 20 years, and we're going to have to maintain one license in this old tool just so that we can access these and set them up for conversion when we need to, because if they've got 10,000 old designs, are they really going to spend a year translating every single design into the new tool, or are they just going to triage it as they need to? But they want to make sure that the parts are all in alignment, and so then they look at, okay, how can we make sure that the parts are mirrored between the two systems?
Yeah, what I would do is I would get a copy of their design source or ask them for an output that can import into Altium. I'd import their design into Altium, make PCB and schematic libraries out of them, take those, clean them up, again, based on their preferences for their Altium layer usage, for mechanical layers in particular. And once I globally edited all those, then I would release them. If they had A365 or something, then I'd set them up to release them into their new server. There's a little bit more work, though. It would be the preferred method is to create a database library. So using the I think it's the parameter manager in the schematic lib, you could go in there and get a basically columns and rows you have to do cleanup and whatnot, and it's best to do it component by component, so all resistors, then all capacitors and whatnot, parts with similar parameters. So sometimes you have to take that larger library and split it up into the specific component types, and then you go into that parameter manager interface, copy and paste into Excel, build your back into your database, assign the symbols and footprints once you clean them up, and basically there you go. That's in a nutshell.
Okay, well, it isn't. It's definitely not a simple drag and drop operation.
Oh no, not by a long.
I think is the main takeaway here.
Yeah.
Well, maybe in the future it will be, but I guess until everyone gets used to standardizing their libraries with all those different parameters, it'll never happen.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, well, if anybody out there that is listening needs these services, and I know that they are needed because, as I said, they do come up from time to time, I would welcome them to contact ECAD Central or contact you directly. We'll include some links to ECAD Central and to your LinkedIn in the show notes. So anybody that's interested, check out the show notes for those links. Mario, this has been a very fun talk, and of course you have educated me on some of the capabilities regarding high or heavy copper boards. This is I never thought I'd hear someone say 57 ounce copper, but there you go.
Yep, they're out there.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining us, and I think we'll leave it at that, and make sure everybody make sure to check out the show notes, and make sure to contact ECAD Central if you are in need of any of these critical migration or server setup services. With that, make sure to hit the subscribe button on YouTube. You can stay caught up with all of our upcoming episodes. And last but not least, don't stop learning, stay on track, and we'll see you next time.